Top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? Isn't that fair? Throw it away. All right?
Tell me about Disneyland.
They got tons of popcorn there.
Yeah.
And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord. It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family.
Nightmares in a damaged brain.
Prepare yourself for the most intensely shocking motion picture of our time. The motion picture everyone's talking about.
Hello? Hello, Steve?
In a damaged brain.
Kathy?
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 176, 1981's Nightmare. Also, pretty well known as Nightmare in a Damaged Brain. So this is Romano Scavolini versus Tom Savini. The latter memory failed him because Scavolino, did I say Scavolini? Yeah. Whichever it is, my memory fails me now. Savini claims that he does not remember working on this film, and yet the director claims he did. So we have these two competing truth claims. One is a fact, one is an alternative fact, if you will. You never know. Savini has worked on so many movies that it's possible he just worked on a few things of this, but regardless, his name still appears in the promo poster to boost the fortunes of this movie.
Well, from what I understand, Savini actually just worked as an effects consultant for this movie, and he helped with some of the design and some of the, I guess, some of the schematics as to how to achieve certain effects, but he didn't do anything hands-on, whereas the director, what's his name again?
Scavolino or Scavolini.
Well, that's we're just going to pluralize it. Pasta dish, you know?
Yeah.
Enjoy with a nice
veal,
some nice carbonara sauce, but he claims, of course, that Savini was hands-on, and, you know, this is one of his, I Love the Prowler, or Friday the 13th, this is one of Savini's masterpieces, but first of all, Savini, I'm going to go with Savini on this one.
I was going to say, too, for any a forensic analysis, when you talk about the Prowler and just how incredibly memorable, let's say, the shower kill was, or the knife kill, or any of his other kills, when you put them in context.
Or the shotgun in Maniac.
Oh my God, yeah. Any of the Friday work, what here would lend itself to anyone thinking this is Savini?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of gore effects in this movie. I mean, basically, that's almost the entire selling point of this movie, is that there's two or three set pieces or scenes of extreme gore, but they're done in a sort of haphazard, amateurish way, I would say. The centerpiece, really, which is repeated over and over throughout the film, is a lopping off of a head, and then you see a neck, and a geyser, and a arterial spray, and then There is a decapitated head, which obviously looks like a mannequin.
Yeah.
And this is not the work of... This is not the hallmark of Savini, in the sense that it's effective, it's gruesome, but with Savini, there's always that veneer of professionalism that this film does not seem to have in any way. I mean, be it acting, be it directing, be it script...
Considerations.
Or continuity or what have you. However... Which is not to say this is a bad film. This is an entertaining film. This is an interesting film. This is a film that, again, is a product of a bygone era. This is a sleaze personified 42nd Street grindhouse classic, also a video nasty. Obviously released to capitalize on the slasher boom that was gripping multiplexes in 81. And this was, we should talk about how this film was came our way.
Yeah, so a long-time listener to whom we're going to give a shout-out because she's been... incredibly supportive, tweeting at us suggestions and recently giving us a what is perhaps the definitive foosball movie of all time that she would like us, its name escapes me, but she would like us to podcast that. And as someone who spent many, many a dollar playing bar foosball, I can't wait to see the Rudy of foosball. Or I don't know what, jeez. D.M. Elms from Oregon actually sent us this movie with a beautiful package that is sort of a collage piece of art that she created.
A wonderful envelope, which is a collage. It was made with her own hands.
A craft work, in a way.
Beautiful piece of work. Yeah,
not the band craft work.
Indeed.
A piece of craft.
And I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to actually tweet a picture of the envelope.
That'd be fantastic.
So everyone can see her handiwork. It's just wonderful. I mean, I'm extremely grateful to receive the movie from one of our listeners, from D.M.
Yeah.
But... even more so, it just when someone makes something with their hands, there's something, there's something so endearing about that.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is not an envelope. When I got this, when I took it out of my mailbox, I did not tear it open. I very gently opened it up so I could keep this envelope as a keepsake. It's just wonderful. And again, you can go to our Twitter account, at @awful_movies, to take a look at it. DM, thank you for the movie, thank you for the envelope, and thank you for listening, and thanks for all your comments. We really, really appreciate it.
For sure.
So getting back to Nightmares and Damaged Brain, it's funny because I remember, you know, I had seen this movie years ago, and I'd forgotten about it, and perhaps maybe some of it has to do with the confusion of title. Is it called Nightmares? Is it called Nightmare and Damaged Brain? There's a lot of movies called Nightmare. There's an anthology film that I recall seeing many a time as a kid on TV.
This will be our fourth film with Nightmare in the title, if I'm not mistaken.
Well,
yeah.
So you hear the word Nightmare and you think, well, okay, is it that one? Is it this one? And then also I hear Nightmare in the Damaged Brain. I think of Cat in the Brain.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I think of something, you know, there's a cognitive dissonance going on. Going on with all the films I've seen with the word Nightmare and all the films I've
seen with the word brain, like Brain Damage, which we podcasted. Yeah.
Or, you know, The Brain That Wouldn't Die, or so on, or, you know.
Which we also podcasted.
Exactly.
It goes on and on.
So, yeah, so when we pop this in, I remember. I'm like, oh, yeah, this is that movie, the one that's with the decapitation.
Yeah.
And it's just an uber sleazy movie. I mean, when this movie begins, the first thing we see is we see this horrendous decapitation.
Hmm.
And that sets the tone right then and there.
Oh, for sure.
And
yeah, and you have it, this being flashed back by the antagonist, who's George Tatum, who's been confined to Branson Mental Hospital and subsequently sent to New York for some radical training to prevent any sort of recidivism. I guess he's a psychopath. They make it clear that he's being treated with this kind of experimental medication. And this is an aside here, but it always makes me laugh. Like, one of the attending physicians is Dr. Davis. And every single movie, like whenever you hear on the loudspeaker, it's like, Dr. Davis, please, you know, paging Dr. Davis. That is the go-to name for every single hospital physician that they're that they want to contact. And it's like, is there anybody else? Like, Dr. Silverberg, Dr. Smith, Dr., like, you know, Pasquale? No, there's the Dr. Davis. Dr. Davis, please. They are pumping this guy full of drugs. He's having these terrible nightmares.
Right, and when we first meet him, he's in the midst of... after we see him flashing back to this horrendous decapitation, he wakes up, and he's lying there in a bed with bloodstained sheets. He's writhing around. He's screaming bloody murder. He's wearing a pair of tidy whities.
Yeah.
He sees
a decapitated head and intestines at the foot of his bed. He screams some more. He rolls around the floor, and you could just, like, the sleaze and the slime, and it just, every frame of this movie is imbued with some sort of grime or some sort of, like,
yeah, veneer, like, of filth or,
It's like, this entire movie felt like urine soaked or something. Yeah. It's really, really disgustingly sleazy.
Yeah.
As you mentioned, he's in this hospital, and he is not a medical deviant, but a sexual deviant who committed some pretty heinous crimes in the past, and he is being treated in order to, quote-unquote, program him so that he's suitable for public or private sector use.
Yeah.
Which makes him sound like Robocop or something.
Yeah, exactly. And pretty much excludes every other type of job. What other jobs are there? Unless you work... I don't even know. I couldn't even name a job that's neither private nor public sector. Oh, I guess illegal jobs if you're a hooker or something. Who knows? And speaking of sex...
Well, that's still the public sector. You're serving the public.
servicing the public. Yeah, I never thought about it that way. Oh, my God.
Don't pay your taxes.
So. Yeah. we should also say, yeah, speaking of sex, this flashback he has is to mommy issues.
Of course.
A hallmark of horror. Mm. In Don't Answer the Phone, we had the rare feature of seeing daddy issues, which is quite unique. But for the most part, whether all the way from Psycho to Maniac and beyond, Friday the 13th, the aforementioned Friday, there's always a mommy issues. Mm. And so mommy is engaged in some minor kinky escapades with a certain figure. I guess they don't really allude to who he actually is. He's strapped to the bed. She's doing him. She gets decapitated.
Right. He decapitates her.
Yeah, yeah.
As a young child.
Yeah. Yeah. Put it in the active voice, yeah.
Uh-huh. And this device has been used ad nauseum in horror, where a young child sees his mother in the act of sexual deviance, and something snaps. I mean, what was that Christmas movie where I saw mommy fucking Santa Claus? Was Christmas Evil or whatever?
I think it was Christmas Evil because, if I'm not mistaken, John Waters called it his favorite Christmas movie of all time. Right. Mm-hmm. And that has exactly the same setup with a young boy watching from the door as his mommy is engaged
I mean, there's so many movies over there. Oh, my mother was a horror, ergo I'm now a homosomaniac, and that's something that Rob Zombie had to tack on to the Halloween mythos, right?
Oof,
it wasn't enough that Michael Myers was just the embodiment of pure evil. Rob Zombie had to, again, use that tried and true trope of having his mother, she was a stripper.
Yeah, social constructivism versus genetics. Yeah, he created a backstory for Michael Myers to almost justify his actions, which was not required at all, and actually took... deterred from what made the original Halloween so effective.
Now, of course, I mean, if you're going to witness your mother engaging in lewd and lascivious behavior,
and
your first instinct is to, instead of just to run out of the room and, I don't know, maybe require about 30 years of intensive therapy, your first instinct is to grab an axe and decapitate her. There is some sort of genetic predisposition towards, homicidal proclivities there, so.
And hence he's getting this, experimental oddball treatment, which apparently the director Scavolino, based on some nefarious underground CIA treatment that he read about in the New York Times, I believe. So this starts in New York City, like a lot of movies do. It actually straddles, I would say, giallo with slasher. It has interesting Italian sensibilities. It's not really a slasher because you have a masked figure who's sort of stalking a group of people, but there's not like a continuous body count that you would expect from that. And I don't know if that's sort of pseudo-Italian sensibilities. Mm-hmm. It has a little bit of that.
But the only thing, it's not really giallo because there's no mystery as to who the killer is, right? So we know
who
the killer is. When the hallmarks of the giallo is the fact that it's a murder mystery, and it's always a black glove killer. That's pretty much the trope of that genre, and we have to figure out who it is. But I understand what you're saying. I mean, it's not a murder minute sort of slasher. This is, once we get past New York City, and I don't want to brush past it because it's a very successful part of this movie.
But
it's a very slow, methodical movie. It's very slow-paced, punctuated by a lot of scenes of banality, I would say.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then, once in a while, then we get a little bit of the old ultra-violence.
And a little bit of TNA as well. Yeah. There's tons of nudity. And when he I guess, is released upon the streets of New York City.
Well, this is what I want to talk about. So, yeah. So,
he's walking around the Deuce, like 42nd exactly. Street and in the 80s.
We always, you know, most people, when they want to talk about, okay, well, if you want to see a cinematic representation of what the Deuce was like, go watch Taxi Driver, or in the horror space, go watch Basket Case.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
I mean, this movie, I think, is even more of an accurate representation of 42nd Street in the late 70s, early 80s, because he's just walking around. I mean, Midnight Cowboy would be another one.
Oh, but, yeah, yeah. But, I mean, he's just from the late 60s, and that got a triple X for mm-hmm. whatever reason. But, yeah, this he's walking yeah. around. He goes to a peep show, which, you know, Toronto's Yonge Street was notorious for this. And
way back when,
probably
yeah.
all of us lost our strip club virginity somewhere along the Yonge Street strip. Whether it was the Brass Rail or the whatever, the Zanzibar. Various Zanz Club, Zanzibar, all these places where you go in and these are just denizens of pure and unadulterated sleaze.
On Dundas and Young, just a little bit. That was a really sleazy one.
There's one with like a shower
Fillmore's,
on the
other. It was Fillmore.
Fillmore's on Dundas East, yeah. But that was another like a biker run, just a house of degeneracy. Mm-hmm. And
before our time in Yonge Street, they also had these peep shows.
Yeah,
like this. Okay, you're talking about, you know, when we would go see strip clubs and see strip acts, but they had actual peep shows where you would go in there and you would sit down and
with coin operated, like
you would have like a little private booth.
Yeah,
kind of. I guess, you know, Madonna's "Open Your Heart" video. Remember that? Mm. That was a sanitized version of one of these things.
Yeah,
you'd be in your own private booth. Why a private booth? I don't know. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
but. And there'd be a woman dancing, and you would put some money into a slot. I don't know if this is a personal experience. I've never gone through any
No, it was, sort of, it was before our time,
right.
Yeah.
And this partition would open up, and you would get a minute or two to see this woman dance before it would close again, and then you would have to keep putting in money in order to continue the show. And he goes to one of these shows, and he watches he puts in his money, and he gets his minute or two, and he gets extremely turned on.
Yeah.
And one of the consequences of that, and I believe this is because of the treatment and the medication.
Yeah, it could have been something pre-existing, but probably was the treatment.
Right.
He has this terrible seizure,
right.
And he's foaming at the mouth like he's rabid. That was pretty intense,
and
I got to admit.
Yeah, and this sort of negative behavioral therapy where if something happens, some sort of negative effect, it reminds me of like Clockwork Orange or
any sort of shock therapy that is associated with any untoward visuals that they're trying to dissuade you from doing again.
So,
they're trying to prevent recidivism and this weird treatment.
So basically what they're trying to do is they're trying to equate sexual arousal with pain and convulsion and nausea and so on. And I guess by doing that, he's able to go back in the street and be fit for the private or public sector. Anyway, amazing, amazing depiction of good old, dirty, sleazy, disgusting New York City way back when.
Well, this is divided chronologically into the ominous day one, first night. Mm. That's New York City. Day two, where he gets in a car. And hilarious that the powers that be cannot keep tabs on him. They put maybe an APB out on him or something.
Well,
where there's no, he doesn't show up at the halfway house.
He was residing in a halfway house. He escaped.
Yeah, where is this
very
guy?
Very lax security.
Yeah.
And he's on the road. On the road again.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Gonna go off and do some killing again.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's you mentioned the banality earlier of just these long stretches of stuff not happening. So he's on this on these highways and the interstates and the U.S. South. He's driving through Carolina, driving through Myrtle Beach on his way to Florida. And in the interim, he stops off at a home that's populated by a couple of lovebirds, Barbara and her boyfriend. I don't even know if he's named, and they're in the throes of passion. He goes in, sneaks up on her from behind, and I can't remember if it was this one or a subsequent killing where he just grabs her by the neck, throttles her, knifes her. And in very unconvincing fashion, as we were watching this, you said, like, you could see the handle wiggle as one of those, like...
Those retractable knives.
Yeah, retractable knives. Yeah, yeah, which is lends further credence to the fact that Tom Savini was probably not the mastermind behind this. But yeah. But there was still...
Did you have one of those knives?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, it was great.
The blade goes into the handle, and you...
But even...
You gotta love the fact that when we were growing up, they actually sold toys that we could, used to pretend that we were, like, homicidal maniacs, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, whether it be, these retractable knives, whether it be candy cigarettes, whether it be switchblade combs,
oh my god,
toy guns aplenty.
Oh, for sure. I even remember, like, a very high-powered slingshot, and also, like, an air rifle that I had that took out, like, big pieces of drywall in my basement that I would shoot at, and I remember, like, oh, like, the slingshot that I had was just way too powerful to be in the hands of, under the control of a little kid, and we'd go out and try and hit the odd bird. It was, God, yeah, maybe revealing too much, like, maybe I had the makings of a psychopath right there, but, yeah, I actually, it was cheesy that it was retractable, but still,
yeah,
we're just killing this woman, Barbara, and sitting on top of her, and again, I was totally taken out of it by the retractable blade, but he's sitting on top of her, just repeatedly shoving it into her innards, and then he licks the blood very, very slowly off of her, and off, I believe, off his hand. And I thought, okay, even if I was taken out of the scene, I thought that was particularly sleazy in a way that the typical kill-a-minute slasher, as you put it, doesn't really have that sort of intimacy between killer and victim. It's usually just, oh, I've got a pike, I've got a sword, I've got something, and then boop, Bob's your uncle, done, and he goes on to the next victim. So I thought it was actually particularly affecting.
Well, that's also more of the Euro sensibility. I mean, in the American movies, there wouldn't be that intimacy in the sense that, like, yeah, boom, in, out, done, kill, money shot. But in these Euro films, oftentimes, yes, once the victim is deceased and the killer is still lingering with the body, I think we saw that in Torso, a film that we podcasted about back when. So yeah, that's also, I guess that's where some of the Euro sensibilities of this comes from. So there's that kill, but ultimately his destination is Florida.
Yes.
And there's a child by the name of CJ. CJ Cook. He's tormenting the Cook family.
Yeah, for sure.
And CJ Cook is played by none other than CJ Hamter.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess they wouldn't have to call him something other than CJ to make things easier on the acting front.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess without spoiling it, he travels to Florida in order to stalk and kill this family. So we're not going to divulge any more details there, because this might be worth our listeners checking out, if only for Video Nasty Completist, but it has a lot of things going for it, so we don't want to touch too much on who the victims are in the Sunshine State.
Well, there's a little bit more I want to discuss. I mean, first of all, there's, you know, CJ is an interesting character, because he's being stalked by George Tatum, and this film does sort of play with your expectations a bit, because he'd be going outside playing, and he'd see George across the street, and all of a sudden he'd run into the house, and he's clutching his stomach, and he's like, "Oh, I'm a stab."
Yeah, yeah.
And it's worth saying he's being raised by a single mother who has a boyfriend, kind of a hippie-ish kind of thing.
Yeah.
And he's covered in blood, and you think, "Oh my God, Tatum stabbed him." But meanwhile, CJ's playing a prank, and it was, I don't know, it was like a syrup or something.
Yeah,
he missed it. And so, despite the fact that he's literally being stalked by somebody who wants to take him out, who wants to kill him, he's also playing these pranks to scare his family. Almost like Tommy Jarvis-esque in Friday the 13th Part 4. And
the pranks are, you would get the sense that they're being reciprocated by his friends, too, because when this psychopath phones the home to further stalk them, he thinks it's a friend of his pulling his leg with some prank phone call that we all used to do as kids. Not to the same psychopathic extent of, like, a heavy-breathing psychopathic caller on the other end of the line, but, so it was an interesting conceit that the kid is a budding Tom Savini, if you want to, you know, square the circle.
Yeah. And as they're watching this, and at one point they're on the beach, and yet again he sees Tatum in the distance, and he says, "Mommy, mommy, I see him again." And the boyfriend says, "You know," and I said to you, I said, "Man, he's like the boy who cried wolf." And then the boyfriend then says,
"Have you ever heard
the story of the boy who cried wolf?" And then he utters the line, says something like "Coco Pinocchio."
Coco Pinocchio. Yeah, exactly. I've never heard that before.
Coco Pinocchio.
Yeah.
Coco Pinocchio stories or what have you. Other things that I want to talk about, because if we, without divulging too many details, there is a mask worn by
the killer
at a certain point in this movie, and
it's funny. I mean, they probably just picked up this mask at some dime store, you know, some novelty store down in Florida.
Yeah, yeah.
But it looks like Sid Haig.
Sid Haig, yeah,
like a Sid Haig mask.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not talking young, good-looking Sid Haig from, like, you know...
Rob Zombie Sid Haig.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Captain Spaulding Sid Haig. So that was kind of interesting. But
yeah, not the Big Birdhouse Sid Haig. Yeah, this was a more aged, more sinister-looking Sid.
Yeah. But throughout this movie, like I said, I mean, you just get this real... Everything, it looks sleazy. The decor of... the home of this family he's stalking. It just looks so ugly. This film looked ugly.
Everything,
you know, not one character could remotely be described as Hollywood attractive. Nobody, there's no face or name that you can glom onto. Go, okay, well, that's, you know, that's so-and-so, so I recognize him. Ergo, you know, I know this is a movie. No, this sort of had almost a cinema verite sort of feel to it.
Oh, yeah.
To a certain extent. And everything was not just... ugly, but very real. Like, when you talk about nudity, the copious amounts of nudity, like, there's a scene where the mother of CJ is talking on the phone with her boyfriend, and she's talking you know, no, very unceremoniously, takes off her top,
yeah.
puts another top on, you get a quick little boob shot, and so on, and it's just so matter-of-fact that it just lends this film this real sort of anti-Hollywood veneer, which makes it quite effective.
So I guess, yeah, that segues into what we've learned.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to just, you know, build on that point for what I've learned. Yeah, very voyeuristic feel to it, and probably due to budgetary constraints, was the scene where Barbara is making love to her boyfriend, who's also got the tighty-whities on, and there's this lingering shot of
his... Barbara again? Who
was... Barbara is just the second-day victim.
Right.
She's immaterial to the plot. They're shagging, and it's almost like he's watching from a distance. From a distance. And it's just this sort of humping from across the room where you just see this bare buttocks, and it definitely adds to the heavy breathing creepo factor. And then he goes to, if I'm not mistaken, he goes to find a joint or a cigarette, and then of course the two get separated, and that's never good for life expectancy and horror, so Barbara becomes, I think... maybe he becomes the first victim, I can't remember which, but that was had an interesting feel. By no means was this particularly well shot, but again, a cinema verite feel to it, very low budget. It engaged you on some levels on that respect. So if you don't have much to work with, at least you have this sort of shaky camera following the intimate exploits of certain to-be victims. That can be a little bit evocative, can be a little grabbing. What did you learn?
Well, it's interesting because there is a very fascinating horror film called Night of the Seagulls. And although this film is not Night of the Seagulls, I think it can be called Day of the Seagulls because there are so many goddamn seagulls in this movie.
Yeah.
So many scenes with, you know, on the beach, and there's a plethora of seagulls. I don't know if there's a term
like a gaggle of crows, or I don't even know if that's right. Yeah, for seagulls.
So
there's
a plethora of seagulls, and I turned to ask you, like, did they have a seagull wrangler?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, there are so many seagulls.
Oh my god.
And I just imagine, like, you know, the poop situation with the seagulls. Just to add to the sleaziness,
the
set must have been covered in bird shit, so...
Yeah, well, what do we give this?
Okay, well, hey, you know what? No, five-star classic this one. But if you're looking for some sleaze, if you're looking for something that's a really good representative of the whole grindhouse... Like, you know, a lot of people say, what is Grindhouse? You know, what is Grindhouse? What is a Grindhouse movie? This is a Grindhouse movie.
Yeah.
It's... you could totally picture yourself sitting in some disgusting, smelly, decrepit theater on 42nd Street in the early 80s, you know, watching this movie while somebody beside you...
was wearing a trench coat with his hand down his pants.
Yeah, yeah, was beside you, was getting pleasured orally, and so on, and somebody's, shooting up behind you.
Yeah.
And just, you know, that experience was just totally lost to the ages, but this is...
Probably a good thing, yeah.
We have some warehouses here in Toronto as well that, you know, unfortunately have obviously shuttered their doors, but, I mean, this is the sort of film that would be unspooling on the screen while all these shenanigans would be happening in the audience. This is Grindhouse personified.
Yeah.
In a way, maybe that's why the languidity of the movie and the fact that not a lot happens for a lot of stretches is almost to its favor, because when it came to the Grindhouse, a lot of people were doing much more than just watching the movie.
That's for sure.
And the movie was there to, oh, look at that, get a little cheap thrill, but at the same time, then you want to go back to your shooting up or whatever the heck you're doing.
Your fly-by-night motel. So, star rating. Yeah.
So what I'm saying to you is that, you know, if I was to put my serious critic hat on, I would have to say that this is like a two and a half.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a good representation of, like, the, you know, grindhouse cinema, and again, a bygone era of both movie making and the way things were. To get a little sentimental, I'm gonna get maybe a 3-star. I'll bump it to 3 stars.
Yeah, sure. Likewise, anywhere between 2 and 3. Another thing I learned, I forgot there is an actual, I don't know if this is any sort of high-minded reference, but the hippie character, the boyfriend of one of the stalked victims, references Antonioni's blow up,
yes,
which is very weird, and I can't remember the context. It's been a week since we saw this, but I thought, oh, that was quite amusing as well, and quite out of left field. I did not expect to see such a highfalutin, if you will, reference. Mm. So, anyway, for more, check out our website, www.reallyawfulmovies.com, and we'll definitely fill in the gaps when it comes to the rest of the Video Nasty series. We've covered a lot of them and other genre films from the 1960s to today and sometimes earlier. And follow us, awful_movies. And again, a shout out to DM Elms for the wonderful gift. Thank you so much. And to all our other listeners for being so dedicated listening to us. And we'll talk to you soon.
Take care. Thank you.